here with my good friend Marcel, and we are marked safe in the great Facebook outage of 2019. But that doesn't matter. We are here presenting to you the Jazz and Grass and Other Stuff 2 podcast.
Hey, what's up, my dudes? Marcel over here. Just in case you don't know, Jazz and Grass is primarily an Instagram account that we run where we post a new guitar lick every single day of the week. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you'll get a new bluegrass lick from me, Marcel. And then Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, you'll get a new jazz lick from Lyman right over there.
That's me.
Now, during this podcast, generally, we just talk about whatever we want, music-related stuff. Sometimes we get a little off the rails, but Lyman, I know that recently you had some computer trouble.
Yeah, I was getting ready to do this podcast, and my PC went what I affectionately refer to as ripperoni. Just went ripperoni. It wouldn't turn on.
Ripperoni, dude. Does that mean like, were you getting anything? Were you getting like the Xbox, like Red Ring of Death or anything?
Well, the light would come on the power thing when I pushed the button. A little blue light came on, but I wasn't getting that beep that signifies that it's turning on.
Yeah, you were getting that blue boy, but you weren't getting that beepy boy.
Yeah, yeah. And this is not so long after. I was having one of those Mac versus PC debates. I got a buddy. He's a PC user. Really wants to jump ship to Mac because apparently they just work better and PCs never work.
And really?
Yeah, that's what he thinks. And I told him, I've never had a problem with a PC. If a PC doesn't work, it's user error. It means you're stupid.
Yeah, I think what you're really arguing about there, by the way, this is not guitar related at all. But yeah, what you're kind of arguing there is that it's like Mac has a more user-friendly interface, and it always has. It's always been easier to use, but PC has always been more customizable. You can sort of do whatever you want with it. It always feels like that. You can make it look and behave however you want, and if you make mistakes, it'll look and behave terribly.
Yeah. And after arguing all that, my PC goes down because from my viewpoint and belief, I'm an idiot and I don't know how to make things work properly.
Yeah. Well, it's all of that illegal downloading that you do. Hello, FBI. How you doing?
Hello, FBI. Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
That's just kidding. Of course, we're musicians. We would never illegally download anything unless we were 13 years old, and we're very, very sorry about that. We won't do it again.
Yes, yes, FBI, sir.
You know, it's funny that you bring this up, actually, because my girlfriend, Kirsten, if you guys are fans of my YouTube channel, you've probably seen her in some vlogs and stuff. She recently, she got a new job where she works, kind of a promotion, and she got a new work laptop. And this time she didn't get a PC. She had to get like a little MacBook. And I thought it was interesting. That was an interesting choice. She's doing a lot of work with the Creative Suite, you know, like Photoshop and Illustrator and Premiere Pro and After Effects and all those programs. And all the programs that I use every day too. And yeah, I guess the company is of the opinion that those programs run better on, you know, giving her a MacBook, they thought they would run better. And I don't think that's true. I think they run beautifully on PC. I would argue that some of them run better on PC.
Yeah. As far as software goes, like, I've never had a problem with running software if the hardware in my PC it is, you know, up to par. The argument that I have heard is that hardware will run a lot better on a Mac, like your interfaces, your audio interfaces.
Oh, really?
Things of that nature. They fail less often. I don't know how true that is, but
do Macs have a different solution to all of the, you know, the thing that we're always trying to kill with audio interfaces is the latency. And so, you know, they keep coming out with new versions of USB or the FireWire or the whatever. Is there a Mac equivalent? Do they have like a Mac specific solution to that that I don't know about?
They had Thunderbolt cable.
Thunderbolt, yeah, that's what it is. That's what I'm thinking about. Yeah, is that still a thing? Did that die?
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I've been a PC guy since like 97.
Yeah. I would say PC Master Race, but I've found that saying Master Race after anything is a bad idea.
Yeah.
That's just something we don't do.
But if you are into PC, check out the subreddit PC Master Race.
Yes, that is where they all hang out. Anyway, I recently got a new laptop, and I'm still...
Tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm still running Windows, but we were... My old laptop was crapping out. It was just a big old Dell with a giant screen. I don't remember exactly what the model is because I forget things so quickly. But the the new one that I got when I was hanging out at Best Buy, actually, I looked at a bunch of them online, and there was a sale going on for President's Day at Best Buy, and I was like, oh, I'm going to get like internet prices in person. This is perfect. And so I went to Best Buy and I was looking at all the different laptops. And there was a very nice salesman there. His name was like Eric or something. Shout out to Eric possibly. And I told him what I was going to be running and what I was going to be doing. He was like, you should just buy a gaming laptop. And I was like, dude, what a cool idea. Why didn't I ever think of that before? So I got the Dell G7, which I thought was so hilarious. The laptop is called G7. And I was like, perfect. Perfect. Next time when I upgrade, I'll upgrade to just the C. It's a transitional.
Do you know the specs on it?
No, I don't know off the top of my head, man. But that was something we spent a lot of time looking at. And this was the most overpowered laptop. Gaming PCs tend to be, or gaming laptops tend to be a little thicker because the parts are actually modular, right? So you can like screw off the back and put mm-hmm. new stuff in there, unlike a normal laptop, which I thought was incredible. So the only thing that this laptop is lacking is that the hard drive's a little small. I only have 250 gigs, which I hate, but I run everything off of Google Drive anyway. So on with the Google Drive cloud storage, I can just download the files that I need to work with at the moment. So whether I'm making a YouTube video or doing the Jazz and Grass Licks or whatever, I just download those files to work.
Mm-hmm. Another reason a gaming laptop would be super good for you is just the graphics card.
Oh, yeah.
That'll help video rendering. Like, you don't need to be playing games to make that thing in work.
It's insane. So making YouTube videos on my old laptop, sometimes a YouTube video, you know, somewhere between like 10 and 20 minutes would take like 8 or 9 hours to render. So I would have to leave it all night. And if it failed, like I wouldn't know. And now on this, it's insane. On this laptop, the same video length renders in somewhere between 8 and 15 minutes.
GPU.
It's wild. Yeah. I had no idea that was even possible.
Also, I'm betting your hard drive is small because it's an SSD, solid state drive. Am I correct?
It is indeed, yeah.
Do you notice that your digital audio workstation, Studio One, like boots up faster and like audio files will load faster?
Totally. The only thing, the only gripe I have with Studio One actually isn't with Studio One at all. I use a bunch of plugins from Waves, the Waves plugins. And of course, all of the like audio plugins, all those companies, they really want to protect their work and they don't want you to pirate them and everything, which I'm fine with. But it means that they have like software where you download the software, then you transfer your licenses to the new computer, then you download the installer files. Depending on what version you have, you only have support to re-download or install or retransfer your licenses for like 12 months. So I had a lot of those on my laptop for a long time. And I was like, oh, I don't have support anymore. I have to pay to update my licenses to move them to a new computer. That's ridiculous. I'm sorry, Waves. I love your plugins, but that's absurd that I have to pay more money to move them to a new laptop.
Wow. How much?
I don't remember what it was. It was a lot of plugins though. If you had less, it would have been less money, but it was probably around $50 to move, I don't know, 10 of them or something.
Just to move licenses? Wow.
Yeah, and it was specifically because they updated from like version 9 to version 10, so you had to use like a legacy version, and it's hell. I don't even want to get into it, but I eventually got it figured out, and I was like, man, I'm just gonna pay. And I even called their support line, and they was like, oh, looks like we can't help you anymore because you're no longer covered by that. And I was like, oh, you guys. Yeah, it's nonsense.
I am an image line shill. They don't pay me, but I hope one day they do. You get lifetime free updates for FL Studio. Like, and sometimes they'll throw... like, I have I think it's the signature edition. It's the one before the all plugins bundle. And, yeah, I got the license to use it on all of my computers, just as long as I don't, you know, give the license to anybody else.
Yeah. You just
type in the thing. And I know people who have bought, you know, FL8 and now they're on FL20, which is really FL13. But they've got the updates for free, which is
they
super
count,
cool business model.
They count like Windows.
Yeah. 1, 3.1, 95, 98, 2000 XP.
Windows 7.
7, 8, 10.
Yeah, that's how you count. Although the iPhone counts like that too.
Yeah. Why is that? What I'm nettled now about tech companies counting in weird ways.
And just tell me what version of the product I have, man.
All right, now that we've, you know, gotten rid of our entire audience, let's talk about something music yeah, related.
If you've hung out with us for the last 12 minutes, man, what are you doing with your life?
We're not informed on any of that stuff. We're about to move into stuff that we're at least a little bit informed on.
Yeah. So you ever notice that sometimes when you're playing your Kleenex box guitar that the rubber bands like get all weird and grimy and you have to change them out? But for real, all right, so the other night I was messaging you very late at night, as I am wont to do, and we were talking about Walkin' Bass.
Yeah, just to improve the mythology of the show and the lore, Marcel and I will message each other late at night, just bouncing off theoretical music concepts and what we think of them. It's a very healthy bromance.
It is indeed. So I'll give some backstory on why I was talking to Lyman about this. So I play, of course, I play a lot of like walking bass when I'm playing bluegrass stuff. And I'll give you an example, right? A lot of it feels like this. A bum note in there, but that's fine. We'll leave it. It goes forever, and now everyone will know that I hit that bum note. But yeah, that's the idea. It's all pretty straight, and it's pretty clear, like when I'm walking to chords, whether I'm using a chromatic approach or a diatonic approach, and it's you know, it's very formulaic, and that's normal, right? Basically, in bluegrass, you have an alternating bass that's just the root and the fifth, and people will play rhythm like that. And the next level is to add those walks. And you can do those walks, you know, twice as fast or twice as slow, right? I could strum in between each walk. Or I could wait till the end of the measure and just shove them all in. You know, that's enough for me and what I do most of the time in my day-to-day life. But I have this friend who's learning how to play bluegrass bass, and he's getting into the walking bass and the theory. And I taught him everything I know, all of that, and how to think about it, how I think about it, how it generally works. Pretty basic stuff. And I was trying to come up with a system for him to think about it with. So I was thinking like, all right, so you have like your root note on beat one, or, you know, however you want to work on those beats, basically you get four notes per chord. So if you have four notes per chord, the first note is going to be the root note. The fourth note is going to be, you know, depending on if you're doing diatonic or chromatic, it's going to be a half step or a whole step below the target note that you're going to hit, which leaves two notes in the middle that could be chord tones, or they could be part of a diatonic or chromatic walk. And that's a really basic way to think about it. But I messaged Lyman and I was like, what else do you do? How else do you think? How do these things become more interesting?
Yeah. And a little bit of background. I went to school to study jazz bass. So this is my area of expertise, if I have one. Not sure if I do, but if I did, it would be this.
You are a hell of a bass player.
So what are the parameters? Like G going to C?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's use that. G going to C. Like what are some of the different ways you can approach it? So me personally, I would think like G, A, B, C is a really obvious diatonic walk that ends up with a half step leading tone. And then if you wanted to go chromatic, you could go G, A, B flat, B, C would be like an obvious choice that includes the minor third.
Yeah, both of those are perfectly acceptable. Something like the way I conceptualize like one chord going to another chord and you have four beats. Beat one is the root. 80% of the time, 80 to 90% of the time. I'll get into that later. and then on beat four, you have either diatonic note below, diatonic note above, fifth above or below, or a chromatic note above or below. In this case, chromatic and diatonic note below would be the same. So
yeah,
you have things like, or usually when I'm thinking of beat three, I'm thinking of a strong chord tone, something that will, you know, sound the chord. So usually beat three, I'll play the third, the fifth, or the seventh. So we have beat one, root, beat three, chord tone, beat four, a note that can resolve down to the next chord. Chromatic above, below, diatonic above, below, fifth, circle of fifths motion above, below. That leaves beat two.
Yeah.
What can we do on beat two? We can do all sorts of things.
Chromatic?
Yeah, chromatic to the chord tone. You play another chord tone. You play the root again. I do that a lot. Here's a cool one. I kind of broke my rule on beat three there a little bit. I played an A rather than a strong chord sounding tone.
But since it feels, I mean, it's like half chromatic walk, half diatonic walk, like your ear understands what's happening there.
Yeah. You're just trying to get from one chord to another. And in a vacuum, like one chord going to a downbeat is pretty easy. Not easy, but simple. When you have to do that over multiple changes over multiple choruses, that's when things get a little bit interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was, you know, just now you were making me think. And so I was thinking, so B1's going to be our G note. And then B3 should be a strong chord tone. And it could be the seventh, right? So I could have another note, seven, and then some kind of block into C or, right, like you did. And that means that you could, I don't know, you could use octave displacement, which is something that I would have never thought of. You could do G. Right, instead of going, which would be crazy because you're getting an F sharp in over the G chord.
Absolutely. I use octave displacement all the time when I'm playing walking bass lines, because that'll usually allow me to use an open string and then jump up to a higher position on the neck. I'm talking about upright bass here.
So, right, but it's very much like the escape note kind of idea in bluegrass, where if you're playing somewhere and you get in a spot where you're stuck, you can use an open string to get out and move your hand wherever you want.
Yeah. Just think of that, the upright thing. It's a lot easier for me to play intricate patterns on electric bass when I need a little bit more time to actually set my hand position so I can play the next note in tune.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's talk about something like a 12-bar blues and walking bass line.
Yeah, please.
As the parameters. So 12-bar blues. And then you can do.
Lyman's playing a jazz blues.
Jazz blues.
Yeah, and if you want to think about that more like Lyman, the first line of that blues has a four chord in it. It's probably the first change that some people might not notice. And then in all the other chord instances, he's adding like 2-5-1s or just sort of 5-1 movements to get to all the other chords. And that's a really simple way to think about it without any kind of extensions or other things going on.
Mm-hmm. And there's, you can go way down the rabbit hole on a jazz blues.
There's lots of ways.
Maybe we'll get there today. I don't know. But so, like, I'm in the key of G, so I can use a lot of those lines. First chord is G, then it goes to a C for G 4-bar, C 4-bar, and then back to G. Or two bars. You can actually play a little 2-5 to C7 on bar 4 if you wanted to. That was a chorus of me just playing a walking blues line like I would without like thinking about certain things. Couple of things that I did there that were a little bit weird were I resolved to the third of C7 in bar 5. And then I resolved to the fifth of the G chord.
So that's a great way to get kicked out of a bluegrass jam. But
yeah.
and if you are a bluegrass player listening to that too, and you're having a hard time following those changes, hopefully what Lyman just said helps you a lot, that he's not pounding the root on B1 every time the chord changes.
Mm-hmm. And that goes into that thing I was talking about. Usually B1 is the root, 80 to 90% of the time.
Right, and there's some movements that you really want to take advantage of. You know, for instance, if you're going from, right, if you're going from G7 to C, like you just did, you, you know, one of the really strong movements between those chords is that the seventh of G, that F note, wants to go down to the third of C. So yeah, you conceivably, that makes a lot of sense to resolve down to the third. But then, like you just played, you end up with the root note on your second beat. So if you're not aware that that's a choice that the bass player might make, you could really easily get confused.
As a bass player in a jazz group, you really have a lot of power in deciding the harmony. I knew a piano player that played with a bass player that told said piano player, if you keep using your left hand like you do, I will cut it off.
What you're talking about when you say you have a lot of power as a bass player is that you're, of course, you're playing like a consistent walking line, but you're also creating like a perceivable, simpler, you know, like second line that is a walk that makes sense. For instance, just there where you played the root of the G chord, then you use the seventh to move to the third of the C chord, and then you resolve to the fifth of the D chord, you were creating this line. There's just a bunch of notes in between. That's all that was happening, though.
Yeah. And a lot of times when I'm walking bass over the first bars, I'll play something like this. That sort of movement.
Yeah, and that feels very turnaroundy.
Yeah, you're pretty much over the second half of that C7 chord. You're substituting C7 or F7, so you get something like. I ended up playing the whole chorus. I got distracted.
Yes. Conceptually, it makes a lot of sense to me. I can't play it back to you, but I understand what you're doing and I hear what you're doing.
And you can substitute all sorts of chords to get different movements. Like, instead of playing four beats of G7, to start the line or the chorus, you can play two beats of D7, two beats of G7 to get to that C. So you can play something like over the first two bars of a jazz blues.
Which totally makes me think of something that I want to talk about later, and I'm going to write it down.
Okay. Smart boy. a lot of what I do walking bass-wise is super, super triadic. So, yeah, your G major triad with the root on top. And what I like to do is I like to be able to play all the permutations of those four notes. I think I got one in there twice, but that's a good exercise to do with all your triads, all of your diatonic triads.
Right, you're trying to turn them into a line instead of just playing them in order.
Yeah. You can do them with your seventh chords as well. That's a chorus. I've played over a blues probably, you know, hundreds of times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an awesome way to think about all those things. And I think that it's something that everyone should spend more time with, you know, sort of how the chords are linked together in the lowest part, in the most foundational part of the harmony.
Another thing I wanted to touch on is all of those exercises are great. If you're walking some bass, you should know your scales. You should know your diatonic triads, your diatonic seventh chords. You should know the common substitutions. And then once you've got all of those under your fingers a good degree, then you should start paying attention to what's happening in the melody. And that's very important.
Who cares about the melody?
I used to play bass a lot in a sort of trio setting. Drums, bass, and saxophone. So there was no chording instrument to inform the harmony. So that job lied on me, the bass player. And so I had to do a lot of interesting things to sound the harmony, and a lot of that had to do with essentially just counterpoint, playing a counter melody to whatever the lead player was playing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, if say we're in the key of G, we're in the middle of the form, and we're over a G chord, the lead is playing a high G. I would hit, that's a scenario where I would hit the downbeat on the third.
Right.
Or the fifth. That would be the line I would play over the G chord. Or
in the bluegrass world, a lot of times, you know, what you're talking about is you're talking about a situation where there's two lines. There's a lower line and there's a higher melody, and they have to work together in a counterpoint kind of way. When you're doing like bluegrass harmony singing, and there's a lot of really good guys out there that can totally improvise how those harmonies work. And some guys sing in the straight lead and the guy singing the tenor above is making choices about whether he wants to sing, you know, the third above, or whether it makes more sense on the chord to sing the fourth above, or if the chord's about to change, so he's going to sing that dominant seventh, or all of those things. He's making all of those choices and improvising that harmony line on the fly instead of just doing the obvious choices, which is what I do, because I'm not an excellent tenor singer. I'm an average tenor singer. And one of the things that happens a lot is that if you're not sort of thinking a couple steps ahead, is you might accidentally play the same note at the same time, which is what's happening in this scenario when you have a bass player and just a saxophone player. You don't really want to have that moment where you both play the same note at the same time, because that's mm-hmm. not really helpful. That's that's not doing anything good for us. And we call that flashing. When you accidentally sing the same note as someone else, you flashed with them. You get a moment where you lined up, and really that's not what you want to happen, right? You always want to have two separate lines going on. So yeah, what you're talking about is just avoiding a flash.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes it's, you know, it's inevitable in a bass saxophone setting. You shouldn't really start the tune on a third of the chord if the melody is on the root.
But later on.
Yeah, later on, that's totally acceptable. Yeah, you just gotta inform the harmony. You don't have, with just a bass and a saxophone, that's essentially two monophonic instruments. And so you only have two voices. You want to get it, you want to get out as much information as you can with your two voices and avoid doubling if possible.
One of the things that I really like doing, improvising over like a fiddle tune, if I'm in a scenario where there's just two players, like for instance, if there's just two guitar players, and I used to do gigs like that back in Bellingham with Zach Bauman, shout out to Zach Bauman. We would take passes of the tune together, and we would both try to play a line that informs the harmony from a different direction, right? And which is a huge, excellent, you know, listening exercise, right? For instance, if the chord's going from G to C to G, right, someone might play that line that we talked about earlier, where they're thinking about the root note of the G chord, the dominant seventh of the G chord, the third of the C chord, and then the fifth of the G chord, right? And if they're doing that, you have to come up with something else to do. You might think of the G and then the A and then the B as your leading tone into C, right? And then you're playing a one line's going down and there's improvising around it. The other line's going up and there's improvising around it. And hopefully you're not really overlapping with each other. And that's the kind of the best listening thing you can do. If you can find another player to improvise with and you can go over chord changes, try to listen to what they're thinking and the choices they're making and try not to clash with them. There's also a really there's a really funny video of Brian Sutton and Chris Thiele playing together. And I think we watched it together one time. It's like an hour long and they're doing this free improvisation and they keep slipping in certain tunes and other things. They slip in like some Beatles tunes. They slip in like at least five fiddle tunes and they keep coming back and singing verses of another tune. It's very interesting and very like free form, but with lots of like call outs to different tunes. And there's a moment where they're improvising and they're doing this, I think it's a circle of fifty kind of movement. And they're both improvising and informing the harmony in a different way. And you feel that the chords are moving, but they're just, you know, they started on this motif and they just continue it. And they both land on the same note. And you just see both of them go, ah, and like they both start laughing and they realize how funny it is. And they both play the same note for like, they both play like the same line for like a measure as if to acknowledge like, oh, we goofed. We got to, you know, we got to make a meme out of it now, right?
That's the best. Like when musicians acknowledge something and then just meme it out for a little bit. And of course, that can be overdone.
Right, yeah. The entire performance should be an inside joke.
Yeah. But what's crazy to me, and I'm going to bring this back to Bach like I do, is that multi-line counterpoint improvisation. Bach could do that with four voices at a time. He could improvise fugues, which is just insane to me.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So if you haven't listened to your Bach this week, it's like musical vegetables. Get your Bach-ily in.
Get your Bach-ily in. Yeah, always bringing it Bach to Bach. Actually, that gives me a genius idea. Do you know the tune Zombie Jamboree?
No.
Oh, it's like I don't know the origin. Now I'm going to sound like an idiot, but it's like a Southern American of some sort, some origin. But it's all about like zombies coming to life in New York City and they all dance together. It's a really weird tune. It's like hilarious and cool. It's like a joke. Yeah, definitely check out the rockapella version because they do a hilarious acapella version of it. But,
rockapella.
Yeah. Rockapella was my first concert I ever saw. the chorus goes back to back, belly to belly. We don't give a damn because we're stone dead already. And it would be funny if someone wrote in an arrangement of Zombie Jamboree for four voices, and it was a Bach arrangement, and they said Bach to Bach. And it was that's so stupid, but oh, it would be incredible to hear.
Somebody get on that right now. What was that thing you wrote down to come at me with later?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So one of the kind of like fringe sounds to bluegrass that comes up a lot is gypsy jazz, right? And the gypsy jazz mm-hmm. language is a lot different from the normal jazz language. Like, you certainly can't fit in, like, bebop lines necessarily over a gypsy jazz tune. Like, you would stand out, definitely. Yeah, I really only have a gypsy jazz language for, like, the key of A minor I feel really good about. And then if I'm in other keys, you know, I try to move those shapes around, but sometimes I don't have great opportunities depending on the key. And that's just me not being very studied at this, you know, other genre that comes up every once in a while. And so I was thinking about playing gypsy jazz stuff in D minor, and I was trying to wrap my head around how D minor could work. And earlier you said that you you will play a D minor chord over G7.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
That I was thinking about this like a bunch last night, and I came up with a really weird way to kind of conceptualize how D minor might work. And I haven't even done it on my instrument yet, but I was just thinking about it. But yeah,
I want to hear it.
Yeah, the idea is, right, you have this D minor chord. And if you're playing gypsy jazz, it's probably got the six in it. Might be something like that. A D minor six chord. And some of you may already see the problem that you get into immediately is that a D minor scale will have a B flat in it, but a D minor six chord has a B major in it, right? So if you're if you got your thinking cap on, you might have the solution already in that what's a version of the D minor scale that has a B natural in it. But yeah, a simple way to think about it, if you wanted to get there on your own, is that the D minor scale has B flat in it, but we need B natural. So if we just change B flat to B natural, what scale do we end up with? We end up with a C major scale, but with a D root, which means that this has to be some kind of mode of the C major scale. And of course it is, it's D Dorian that we'd end up using, right? Mm-hmm. So right away, we have a really easy solution. We have this D minor chord, however you want to voice it, and we can think. Right? And we end up with the note that we want to hit. Right? And that's good. That's a reasonable way to think about things, and that's enough, right? Mm-hmm. But what I saw in that scale shape, thinking about a C major scale with a D root specifically there on the neck, is I realized that there's a Dorian pentatonic opportunity as sort of like a loose framework. So I started working it out, and I was like, what if you had a pentatonic scale that was root, minor third, 4, 5, and 6? Did I say that right? I did say that right.
Yeah.
So, you know, what if you had that pentatonic position? And that pentatonic position is the same as a dominant pentatonic. It's the same as thinking about in the key of G, 1, 2, 3, 5, and dominant 7. So I was like, wow, I already know all my dominant pentatonic shapes. So I have a D Dorian pentatonic that I can immediately just use. So this shape will work great over D minor. Whatever I want, I can switch to that C major scale or D Dorian and have more notes to play with. So that's the direction I was going and what I was thinking. And that even took me a little further because I was like, all right, so obviously now I have a way to play over the entire neck over D minor six chord in a gypsy jazz scenario, right? I can think of my C major scales, or I can think of the G seven arpeggios, or rather the G nine arpeggios, which is the G dominant pentatonic or the D Dorian pentatonic, depending on how you want to look at it, which is a lot. I know it sounds like a lot that you to play over a D minor six chord. You're either thinking about C major or G nine is weird. Obviously all those things will start coagulating in your mind, and you won't have to think about it like that because you won't be crazy. But taking that even further, I was thinking in my head, you know, what are some other things you might do over that D minor chord? One of the really obvious choices is that you can rock back and forth between any chord tone and a half step below, right? You see that in gypsy jazz a lot, just kind of move it. And so in my head last night, I was like, all right, how many notes of the chromatic scale have I used? And if I've done the math correctly, right, just the C major scale is going to give me 7 out of 12. And then if I added like a chromatic walk from 5 to 6, I get another note. What else do I have? You end up with around like 10 notes or so. Really, the only notes that we're not hitting would be what, the major third? Which would be hard to fit over a D minor chord, but you did it the other day in one of your jazz grass licks.
Yeah. 12 notes you can use over any chord. You won't believe number 12.
And then the note that we left out, the minor six as opposed to the major six. Of course, you could include that if you wanted to. That could be like a chromatic bass tone, or you could just straight up use it. So we're ending up with almost all the notes of the chromatic scale. I don't want to do the math right now because that would take a little bit of time, but really the only note that we haven't used is that major third. And I know you already have a methodology for slipping that in. So bam, there you go. There's a whole system for D minor where you can use all 12 chromatic notes, I think.
Yeah. The thing is, there are 8 million different ways to think about this sort of thing. You got to find which way works for you.
Yeah.
When you were saying chromatic walk up to the six, that's a lick I use all the time over minor chords, over any chord really. But
yeah. Yeah, dude. Anyway, it just struck me as really interesting because, you know, really what I was looking for was a system to think about the scenario where I have a root on the A string. You know, how can I play over that kind of D minor shape that looks like an A minor, and I guess what would be sort of a C shape, but a C minor shape. You know what I mean? You know, I'm looking for that A string root. How would I think about that, and how would I play over that? And I just stumbled upon this, like, sort of big explanation, and it's all stuff that I knew and I'd conceptually like written down before and understood, but I just hadn't applied until last night in my head.
I don't know. Buddy. One thing I wanted to touch on was that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Basically, what we have here is the concept of lower neighboring tones. And I don't just say neighboring tones because they're the lower neighboring tones. We also have upper neighboring tones as well. That would be my upper neighbor tone for D, for F, and for the A. You have a choice. You can pick or.
Ooh.
And so that gives you things like.
Right, yeah. Man, I've totally heard people play that too. Yeah. It always comes Bach.
Guess who's Bach? Bach again. Do you watch Letterkenny?
No, I don't.
I highly recommend it, especially to somebody who lived close to the Canadian border for any period of time. It's a show about this small town in Canada, and there's hicks, hockey players, skids. And they do a lot of that stuff, like word games, like they'll just rapid fire when they're, you know, insulting somebody. Pick a word like moist, or in our case, Bach.
Yeah.
And they'll just beat it to the ground, and it's absolutely hilarious. And I wish I could improvise like that. My wife got me the other night really good with a with the word Musk.
What'd she say?
Musk, you be serious? While the show must go on. Stuff like that. Like, I can't even remember them, but I was so upset that I couldn't join in.
That's good, dude.
So yeah, upper and lower neighboring tones, you have them over minor triads and major triads. Like, if you were to change to F major. And some of my first ever licks on Jazz and Grass were upper and lower neighboring tone licks.
Yeah, it's a great way to think about things instead of it being a instead of it being more from that like chord scale or arpeggio approach, which is all things that I just mentioned. Instead, thinking about neighboring tones, you end up with a whole. It's not that you end up with a different language necessarily, but your brain is working different, so you end up playing different lines.
Yeah, like this is a line I love. Stuff like that.
You know, I had when someone explained the and I think it was Nick. I think it was Nick Sokol, actually. Shout out to Nick Sokol. He's the one that told me about the lower neighboring tone if you're playing over a minor chord. Which once again was something that I sort of like conceptually understood but just wasn't applying regularly in my playing. And at some point he played a lick and I was like, man, what are you thinking when you play something like that? And he was like, oh, it's really easy. Like, you know this, like I've seen you do this. But when he said it like that, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, that is a way that you can just put your brain in that mode. But he pointed out that if you're in that gypsy jazz minor scenario, that, so it makes sense over like D minor that you have all of these guys, but over the, dominant chord, like over A7, you have this. You have all of the major ones that you expect because this is a really common, like, transitional chord as you get to A7. So if you're thinking about the A7 chord, you have everything a half step above. Sorry, I don't even know what I'm playing. Right, all of those kind of exist nicely. I guess the seventh doesn't really work out though, huh? You have to use a whole step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, and I'm sure they have lower neighboring tones as well. And that's a great way to come up with sort of like a synthetic scale to play over any chord.
Yeah.
That's this week's challenge. Take a tune, get the changes, and then write out all the upper and lower neighboring tones for those chords. And then see where you can link them together linearly, like what neighboring tones or what chord tones will resolve to so-and-so on the next chord.
It's a smart idea.
Yeah, and write a line, based on that sort of concept, like, I watched a Rick Beato live stream saying you should stop working out your solos. Stop like writing things out and planning them out. And you should improvise, which is, it's true. You should improvise, but if you're not a strong improviser yet, there's no harm in kind of trying to write out new pathways for yourself. And once you get those under your hands, you can throw them in like as you improvise.
Yeah, I really encourage my students to be able to create a, like a white noise kind of sound, like to be able to just give me like a bunch of notes and to not think about it. And that's normally a good way for improvisers to start. So like if we were playing bluegrass, if we were thinking in the key of G, I would give them like the G pentatonic and I would say, not thinking about chord tones, not thinking about anything. Can you just play 8 notes, right? Can you just improvise 8 notes? And most of the time, people who aren't good improvisers struggle with that. They can't do that. And that's a great place to start, because then you have like this fallback language. You're like, oh, yeah, I can just say things. And then at that point, yeah, you give them more language. You give them like this. And you're like, all right, so, you know, give me your white noise and include that as much as you can. Right, that kind of stuff. And that starts sounding a lot more like bluegrass almost immediately. And eventually you're using sort of no white noise in all language that you're assembling in different ways. You're thinking creatively and you're, you know, slipping in and out of these different ways of conceptualizing the fretboard and what choices you might make. And yeah, it's like an easy way to push people in the water and get them started. So if you want to try that, yeah, please go for that.
Mm-hmm. It's like a piece of paper and some scissors. If you have a large piece of paper to cut from, you can cut all the pieces and fit them together however you want. That's like if you have a lot of tools in the toolkit in the brain and the hands that you can grab from. But if you don't have a large piece of paper, it's hard to, you know, acquire more with scissors.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think that's where a lot of improvisers get really frustrated too, is that they start out and they're like, oh, I'm not saying anything interesting, or this doesn't sound good, or this doesn't make sense. I don't know why this note doesn't work. And that's just because you don't have enough language yet. You don't have enough vocabulary yet. And you're at a really hard spot, but that's where you got to push through. I think that's why younger people too, like kids, tend to pick up improvising really quick, because they don't care when they sound bad. They just like, mm-hmm. They just push through this. And eventually they're learning more and more language, and eventually they don't sound bad. And it doesn't occur to them that, you know, that anything's ever wrong. They feel good about what they're playing.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the white noise exercise. Like, I'll give my jazz students the same sort of concept to play. Swing eighth notes over one chord for at like 120 BPM for an indefinite amount of time. Once you do that, you can cut from that. So I'll play just over C major for, I don't know, ad nauseum.
And it's interesting because the white noise has different principles depending on what genre you're getting started. Like when I lay down the rules for the white noise in bluegrass, I say that it should feel really linear. It should feel like a line. I don't really want to hear big jumps, and I don't want to hear the same note over and over again. And I don't really want to hear any kind of ornamentation or triplets or anything like that to start. Whereas listening to your like jazz white noise, I hear a lot more jumps, bigger intervals that are like thirds or sixths apart, and that like triplet ornament that you do, right? That's all things that should be in your jazz white noise that you should start assembling as fast as possible, or those chromatic passing tones, or whatever it happens to be.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do some shredding for a minute, just because over C with the triadic chromatic approach. And with this, you can really play straight eighth or swing eighth notes for literally forever.
That's great. Yeah. Whereas, right. In interest of an opposing viewpoint, right. If I was playing, a continuing like bluegrass line over C, and I'll start with the cliche. Thank you.
How many Fs did I count in there? Was it three? Did you play F three times?
Yeah, and including the chromatic line at the very end. I think so. Right? It's not something that I really want to do too much.
Mm-hmm. I was playing a crap ton of F. Like, that sort of gives me a little bit of movement over, like, I'm playing over C, but it's like I'm substituting G7 for just a second.
Right, yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting how that's the thing that happens a lot when you compare the genres, is that the jazz player naturally wants to create more movement and apply more chords even when they don't exist. And the bluegrass player wants to sort of maintain in slightly stricter boundaries. Not all the time, but, you know, depending.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Anything else to add on that segment?
No, man, I think we about did it. That was a playing intensive one. We did a lot of talking and picking.
Yeah, that was fun. I think we needed that. We had a segment on credit card picks, but we'll do that next time.
Week. Credit card picks next time.
So for all the people, I'm Lyman Lipke. You can find me at lymanlipke.com. It's LymanLipke.com. And that's where you can find all the stuff I do.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Sign up for lessons over Google Hangouts that way.
You got it. You can do it.
I'm trying to think of a way to incorporate the Tyler King stuff that I'm doing. I'll put links to all that stuff on my website as well. I've been doing some video and audio work for a wonderful singer-songwriter named Tyler King, and you'll be able to find all of that on my website at some point, I'm sure.
Yeah, that the Paula Abdul cover is still, that's bumping, man. the straight up cover, it's so good.
Did you hear the Alanis Morissette?
I did, dude. She does. She puts on some of that, like, Alanis too. Like, she sounds like that too.
She really tries to take on the quality of the person she's covering.
Yeah,
which is super cool.
Superstition was super good too when you guys did that cover. It was cool hearing you try to, because there's a lot of like parts in like a band arrangement of Superstition. There's like that bass line and the horn line and like actual like chords going on and everything. And seeing you try to compress that into a guitar part was really cool.
Yeah. She'll I don't know what she'll say if I tell this story on the podcast, but I taught her how to play the Jimi Hendrix chord.
Uh-huh.
And showed her where to put her fingers. And then right after that, I said, okay, now we can play Superstition. that little part in the middle there, just don't worry about that. Don't play it. I'll play it. We'll get it at some point.
That's good, man. That's true. That's all you need. Anyway, all right. My name is Marcel. I do all the bluegrass stuff. You can find all of my stuff at lessonswithmarcel.com. There I got links to my YouTube channel where I put out videos every Wednesday. I have the tab store on there where I put out a new tab every Thursday. About half of those are free. Half of them are paid. It's a bunch of bluegrass classics. Some of them are, famous breaks and stuff like that. Definitely check it out. You can also sign up for Skype lessons on there. I do Skype lessons on Skype and Google Hangouts. I call them Skype lessons because I'm a simpleton. And you also got links to Jazz and Grass on Instagram there. And that's where we post the new guitar lick every day of the week. Monday, Wednesday, Friday is the bluegrass lick. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday is the jazz lick. Please check that out. We feel really good about those licks and we work really hard to get them to you every single day. But I think that's it.
Yeah. Did I tell you we lost our phone number?
We lost our phone number.
For lack of use.
Man, no one's calling us, man. We don't even have a phone number anymore.
But I was I guess nobody tries to get new phone numbers.
Awesome. So give us a call at... But yeah, we've had some awesome messages in the past. Please call in with your questions or whatever. You don't have to talk to either of us. You just leave a message and then we talk about it later. Well, anyway, yeah, thanks for listening. It's been a good podcast. I like this one, man. This is a good one. Yeah, see you later.